We are continuing the discussion on the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So you may remember in the last session we had a very active discussion on this unique concept of yajna. The word, Sanskrit word, is yajna. It's a very important word, and in fact yajna as a Vedic ritual became a very important subject for study and research right from 18th century onwards in many of the European universities, the ancient Vedic rituals. Many of these rituals are considered to be the oldest existing spiritual or religious rites or practices of the ancient Aryans. So whenever there was any active discussion on the culture of the Indo-Germanic religious and linguistic studies, these rituals were always an important subject. Even now, of course. If you are interested, just I don't want to go into details of this, but those who are interested more in this subject can read a book. It's called Agni, A-G-N-I, The Altar Fire. A very wonderful study taken up by a well-known Dutch linguist who studied and taught. He was a very prominent figure in the whole galaxy of the academics of the University of Berkeley. And a book he brought out is called The Altar Fire, Agni, each of the volumes bigger than the Encyclopedia Britannica, with hundreds of plates. And he made a study of these Vedic rituals for almost 40 years. And he passed away around 18 years back, they say. So that's how the word yajna became very well known in this modern American intellectual tradition. But that yajna and the yajna we are discussing are two different concepts. That yajna was a Vedic ritual. Altogether, there are 14 Vedic rituals since being recorded. I can just mention those 14 rituals. So it's called Sapta Havir Yajna and Sapta Soma Yajna. Two types of yajnas. Seven yajnas belong into one category, which includes offering different things on the sacrificial fire. Remember, it did not involve any kind of animal sacrifice. You have to remember, they were all offering ghee, butter, clarified ghee. Of course, it's called clarified butter. It's called ghee. Yogurt, rice, cooked food, many different kinds of food grains used to be offered. So they are called seven yajnas, called Sapta Havir Yajna. Agnyadhanam, Agnihotram, Deshapurnamasam, Agrayanam, Chadurmasyam, Niruddha Pasubendha, Sautramani. Then there were seven Soma Yajnas. Agnishtoma, Agnishtoma, Uktya, Swadasi, Vajipeya, Atiretra, Adiratra. It is very important and still going on in some places in India. It's called Atiratram. And Aptoyama. Now this is only by context I'm mentioning. The word yajna that we discussed and we are going to discuss again today is altogether different. That yajna means the art of contemplating and working together, the art of harmonizing action and contemplation. The art of doing whatever we do with our mind, with our words, with our actions, with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, so that you don't practice spirituality in the place of worship alone. You practice spirituality in the midst of all your secular duties and responsibilities, cooking, teaching, serving, farming, all can be done as an act of worship, as a sacred offering. When we do any of these things without a selfish motive, with a sense of sanctity, as an offering for the welfare of humanity, it becomes yajna. So we are actually practicing yajna right now here, discussing some higher ideas. We don't get any earthly, secular, material benefit out of this discussion. That itself makes it yajna. And we are discussing higher ideas. No matter what religion we belong to, or whether we do not belong to any religion at all, there is a way to practice active spirituality in our life. Not necessarily in a place of worship, not necessarily through certain rituals, but combining a sense of sanctity, unselfishness, and purity of mind in the midst of our ordinary secular duties and responsibilities. So it is called yajna here. Now, and I mentioned in the last class, if you remember, there are three important principles in this concept of yajna. The old Sanskrit statement, satyam, ritam, and dharma. Dharma, of course, most of you are familiar with in the Buddhist tradition also. Dharma. Dharma is something that supports, that preserves, that harmonizes, that brings in an ethical element into our life. Satyam means truth. And then Ritha means a kind of harmonizing principle, a thread of interrelatedness, interdependence, interharmony, inner harmony, that really makes our life livable, that helps us to interact with others, with compassion, with broad-mindedness, etc. I already explained this elaborately, but shall recapitulate because we are continuing the subject again. So as I mentioned, rhythm is one word. It's a very ancient classical concept that you find in the Vedic literature. It is one of the greatest discoveries, spiritual or philosophical discoveries of the ancient Aryan sages of India. There is behind this universe a thread that harmonizes, that unifies, and that that implies kind of interrelatedness, interdependence. You find in family, you find in human interactions. When we do something that is against this balance, we are violating this yajna, this inner harmony, this inner unifying principle. For example, as I mentioned, if you cut down trees, there will be no rainfall, there will be no food grains production, and there will be famine, there will be problems. If you pollute the rivers and waters and air, that will affect human life. So it's an act of violence. It is actually a kind of disturbance. So it disturbs the inner harmony of human life. So it is called adharma. Adharma means the opposite of dharma. What is not righteous, what is not ethically and spiritually appropriate is called adharma. And then there is satyam. Satyam means truth. So satyam or truth is a philosophical principle. Dharma is the ethical principle. And rhythm is something that integrates, that harmonizes, that unifies human life as a cool. And the next verse which we are going to discuss today, 10th verse, tells us that this yajna, this interrelatedness, this inner harmony is already present when we are born. In fact, when we are born, we are actually born into this interrelatedness. So that's called, we are born with this yajna, with this sense of inner harmony. So if a person eats, let us say, unhygienic food, unhealthy food, he disturbs this yajna, this harmony of the human body, and he falls sick. Similarly, when we do things that agitates our mind, then it could make us mentally disturbed. It can create anxiety. It can create problems of the mind. So we are actually upsetting the balance of the mind. As I mentioned in the Sunday lectures last week, the ancient Vedic tradition defines human health, mental and physical health, as being established in this interrelatedness. Prasannatmendriya manaha swastha iti abhidhiyate. It is one of the dictums of the ancient Ayurvedic principles. You know, the Indian school of medicine that frequently you find. Prasannatmendriya manaha. So samadosha samagnischa samadhatu malakriyaha prasannatmendriya manaha swastha iti abhidhiyate. These four Sanskrit lines define physical health and mental health. So, in fact, these verses are attributed to a great ancient Ayurvedic poet and scholar. He's called Susruta. He wrote a number of books, the Bible of Ayurvedic science. It says, when the body is in a state of balance, yajna, in inherent harmony, and also when our mind is in a state of harmony, mind is healthy, body is healthy. Thus we can very easily understand. When we eat, let's say, unhealthy food, it creates problems. When we have stomach pain, stomach is actually reminding us that I am here. When you feel headache, head is reminding you, I am here. When your body doesn't remind you of its existence, then you are in perfect health. Physically. So also when we don't feel agitated, we don't feel anxiety, when we don't have any inner disturbance, our mind is in its natural state of health. That's because at that time we are integrated into this harmonizing principle called rhythm, that is called yajna. So the 10th verse is saha yajna prajasushta purovaja prajapatihi ayena prasavishyadhvam eshavostishta kamathuk. This is the verse, that is 10th verse of the 3rd chapter. So the verse tells you that God at the very beginning created mankind, humanity, together with yajna. So God in this Vedantic tradition is not a God who creates this world and sits outside supervising our activities, promising heaven and maybe threatening with hellfire. No. The God as mentioned here means the divine spark present in all of us. That divine reality present everywhere and present in all of us. And that divine reality is expressed and defined and understood in so many different traditions and so many cultures, in so many different ways. But that reality is one. So it says, at the very creation, when the whole creation was done, when humanity was created with this yajna principle inherent in all of us. And then, you practice the yajna, this harmony, this living in close proximity with nature. living in close proximity with the inner harmony of the universe, then you will prosper. And then this yajna, this harmonizing principle will listen to your prayers, will fulfill all our desires. Well, let us see, for example, if you live with a sense of discipline, without disturbing our own mind and without disturbing others, in perfect harmony with the rhythm, is an English word, rhythm, R-H-Y-T-H-M, the rhythm of the world, the invisible interrelatedness, harmony of universal existence, then we are happy, we'll prosper. If you disturb that, that's one way of disturbing this rhythm is making use of the gifts of nature, science and technology, or whatever we discover, for the destruction of the world, for disturbing the world. When we use these powers and gifts of nature for our own good and for the good of others, and for the preservation of others, for sustaining the harmony in life, then we prosper. That is a statement that comes in the 10th verse. Then the 11th verse is very important. Devan bhavayadanena te deva bhavayantuvaha parasparam bhavayanta shreya param avapsitha. The literal translation is very simple, but the commentators, especially Shankaracharya, who wrote the great commentary in 8th century AD, gives a lot of different interpretations on this verse. I mean, so you should propitiate the devas, gods, small letter god, that's what you find in the translation, with this yajna. What does it mean? Do your work, live your life, but be in perfect harmony with the rhythm of the world, with this principle of interrelatedness and harmony. Don't fight against the existing, the inner invisible harmony that helps us. When nature gives us food, if it disturbs nature, then we will suffer. Similarly, our habits, for example, our habits can disturb our mind. If you live in close proximity with this inherent inner harmony of the universal life, then we will prosper. And this is one way of pleasing God. That's the meaning here. And may those angels or gods be pleased with you. Thus you should practice mutual harmony. You support each other. Now here, the word deva is used, the Sanskrit word, this ancient language, you know. Deva roughly corresponds to celestial beings. That's the meaning here. So in ancient times, let us say, people used to pray to different deities. They used to see and visualize, conceive of different divine principles behind the existence of different universal phenomena. So one divine principle operated every universal phenomenon. That was the principle. So this word deva has got three, four definitions according to the ancient Vedic lexicon that gives comprehensive meaning. Devo dhanadva, dhibanadva, dhyotanava, dhisthanova, bhavadidi. It's an ancient lexicon called Niruktam, which belongs to 9th century BC. The first lexicograph. It's translated into German and French and Latin languages right from 8th century onwards. In English also you may find. It has got 12 chapters. The first human endeavor to write something like a dictionary. It's called Niruktam. 9th century BC work. So it says, the celestial beings are celestial because they listen to your prayers and they help you to live in close proximity with nature. And they also are present in our hearts as the innermost or immanent divine principle. And when we do our work with a sense of sanctity and sacredness and without any selfish purpose, then what happens? We are in perfect harmony with the whole creation. So, here the Gita, this text tells us that behind every good action, there should be a solid philosophy of life. This is a very important principle. Behind every good action. Now, this is very important. In fact, this is what we are going to discuss. Why should we attach a sense of sanctity, some kind of a spiritual meaning? Why should we impose a kind of spiritual meaning to good actions? If we go on doing good actions, is that not enough? A simple question may arise. There are people who will tell you that going about doing good for others is the essence of spirituality. This is a very, very wonderful, very interesting idea. If we go on doing good actions for others without any selfish purpose, that is spirituality. That is perfectly okay. But very often it can just become going about, going around and not doing anything. So, why this happens? Suppose we make it our motto of life ideal to go about doing good for others, helping others, philanthropy or humanism. And so that is a very wonderful idea, no doubt about it. Now, very often, at some point, we may meet somebody for whom we have done a lot to help him, help her. And in return, we don't even get gratitude, we get the opposite of it. So in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, there is a statement, a prominent philanthropist living in the city at that time was told by his students, "Sir, they are all, this particular gentleman is criticizing you all the time." Then the philanthropist said, "I have not done anything good for him, why should he criticize me?" So, it could happen in life. We may do our best for something, somebody, for an institution, for an individual, for the family, for a company, for a firm. We may do our best with total dedication. But in return, we don't not only get a sense of gratitude, a reward or something, but we get punishment. Are we able to withstand that challenge? We won't be able to withstand the challenge. If we only believe in a external form of philanthropy, it could happen. Look at the Gandhi or Buddha or Christ or any of these great men in any country, Lincoln, you find, of course, there are many, all different civilizations and cultures, nationalities have produced great men and women in different countries in different ages. So one special quality that you find among them is they not only did good things for others, but they did that without any selfish motive, and they were not disappointed, they were not shocked, they were not devastated when their good actions were not reciprocated, because they were never expecting any reward or any appreciation or any recognition. Now for that, we need not only a soft heart, a compassionate heart, but also a higher spiritual ideal. Without this spiritual ideal, we may not be able to withstand when our good actions are not reciprocated. So, irrespective of what the reaction from others may be, we should stick to a higher ideal. And that higher ideal is presented here. as Yajna. In fact, that's one of the reasons why, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, when he wrote, Gandhi himself did not write, he was one of his students, disciples, Mahadev Desai, he was a great Sanskrit scholar. Gandhi was not a Sanskrit scholar, but he was a great saintly person. So he wrote a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, and the title he gave was he interpreted Gita as a book teaching selfless action, Anasakti Yoga. That means a work teaching selfless action. So there he says, it is not enough to be always doing good for others, but it is also important that we should cling to a higher ideal. Otherwise, we may not be able to continue doing good to others. This is an important point to remember. That's why the Gita says, for the harmony of the universe and for the good of humanity and for our own inner satisfaction, we need a higher ideal. And when we do this, every small activity, whether it is an action done for the good of others, or it is part of our daily routine, teaching, doing one's own job, fulfilling obligations in the family, in the company, or in the country, the society, whatever may be, all these can be considered to be an act of worship. Worship in Vedanta doesn't mean going to a temple and performing, or place of worship for that matter, and performing a ritual. That's not the real meaning of worship in the Bhagavad Gita. This work doesn't teach you anything about a temple, anything about a place of worship. It doesn't teach you any ritual. It doesn't even teach you that you should go to a place of worship every day or every week. No. What it tells us is, in our everyday life, when we face everyday life situations, we can bring in a spiritual element, a spiritual culture into our life. So we can live our life in such a way that every action brings in this feeling of inner contentment. Well, I have done what I should have done. We Sanskrit philosophers called kṛta-kṛtyata. When we do something, we feel a kind of inner contentment, fulfillment. Somebody, maybe there is a big earthquake in a far off country, a rich person may contribute, he may send a check. That person, that evening, he is able to sleep better because he feels, well, I have done something meaningful. So this spiritual element can be brought into every aspect of our life. Then it's called yajna. Then and in the 12th verse is very, very important. Ishtan bhogan hivo deva dasyande yajna bhavitaha taidattan apradayaibhyo yo bhungte stena eva sakha. Literal translation also needs a lot of explanation, you know. So if we live our life practicing spirituality in whatever we do, in every aspect of our life, then what happens? That will give us not only what we are working for, but also kind of inner satisfaction. But those who take everything given by God, so the word used is God, deva means gods. What it means is nature. So whatever nature has given, if you just exploit and use for our own enjoyment, such a person is a thief. It is something very interesting. The earth is full of wonderful things. Coal, iron ore, bauxite, gold, everything. Petroleum products, everything. And also human intelligence has also created many wonderful things that makes life more comfortable, easier. But then that doesn't always help us to enjoy the fruits of our own labor. We may work very hard, we may become very successful in whatever profession we are engaged in, may make a lot of money, attain great things, but still we may not feel that we have done anything meaningful. So there are many such people who are successful, but only externally. The success doesn't translate into a kind of inner contentment. So sometimes the most successful businessmen have to take medicine for getting 4 hours sleep. So suffering from different kinds of internal problems. That's because there is a disharmony in the way they live. So this verse tells us that when we take something, we have to give back something else or a part of it. So yajna means a kind of religious ritual. Yajna shishta means in ancient times when they used to practice the Vedic rituals, they will offer food grains, cooked food, milk, all these things they used to offer on the fire, ancient Vedic fire sacrifices. And after offering, a part of it will be left out and they will eat it. So that is called yajna system. Not only that, any good action, any action with a noble intention. That's why, you know, the old Vedic literature defined is, you know, yajna vai sreshtha tamam karma. Yajna means any noble and selfish activity. Now, how does it become noble and unselfish? The reason is that activity produces a result. We can find this happening in our life. When we do something good for others, on the one hand, the other person is benefited. Well, that person response may not be what you normally expect, or may be or may not be. We can't predict. It's not within our control. But there is something else that happens in our mind. So any noble activity, whether you are praying, sitting in your own room, going to library, reading a very wonderful spiritual book with the great concentration, feeding our mind with some healthy spiritual food, listening to some great ideas, helping ourselves or helping others. As I mentioned in the last, just a few minutes back, there's an earthquake or some other natural calamities in some distant corners of the world and you spend $1,000. It's an act of kindness and compassion which will benefit suffering people. That action produces one result, which is quite obvious, visible. This money goes to somebody who may be benefited. But something happens to you. That is another kind of reward, another effect, the residual effect of an action. Our mind generates a spiritual vibration, a spiritual energy. That spiritual energy is sometimes it may manifest as a kind of inner contentment, inner joy, inner satisfaction. Well, I had done something that's good for others. So these are two types of result. One result is very, very obvious. The other person is benefited. Doctor treats the patient with a great attention. The patient is benefited. But when the doctor does that job, looking beyond his professional obligations, let us say, well, I am a medical practitioner, so it's my sacred duty, not just a professional duty, but sacred duty to help this patient. So that attitude brings in another aspect, another element into his mind. Then what happens? That kind of activity produces a result. That result is called, in Sanskrit, the ancient tradition, is called adrishtam, means invisible. Apurva means it did not exist before you did that good action. So an effect is produced, a result is produced, which may not be obvious, not visible, but that result is not lost. It is very important. Such activities help people to live better lives. It helps them to live healthier life because they feel a kind of inner contentment, inner harmony and peace. Now, that will not be lost. So, that invisible experience, which may be expressed as inner contentment, inner complete fulfillment, is our own private experience. Others may not be able to see that. But in our life, we feel we are generated a kind of spiritual wealth. Now, Lord Krishna, the teacher, tells us that those who do work, they work like this. On the one hand, they are benefited. Their work benefits them. And also, they are spiritually benefited. And their work serves some good purpose for others. Those who do not work with this higher attitude, what happens? Such a person is taking everything from others, from nature, not giving nothing in return. So he is a thief. A very strong language is used. Stena eva saha. He is verily a thief. That's what Lord Krishna says. So for bringing this additional spiritual element into our everyday life, it doesn't cost us anything. We can just change the way we look upon life, work, and the way we define success, the way we redefine success, so to speak. Because if a person makes lots of money, a wonderful job, but cannot get sleep without the help of medicines, his life is not much of a success. He may have piled up money, but he's not able to enjoy what he has achieved. So it's not a success, really. Success becomes success only when we are able to make use of success, when we feel success. Otherwise, success is actually not much of a success. So every action can be turned into success, something productive, something spiritual. The art of bringing the spiritual element into everyday life, into every kind of activity, is called yajna. So the 13th verse continues this discussion. In fact, there is an interesting quotation from St. Paul's letters to Corinthians. For he that eateth and drinketh unworthily, eateth and drinketh unto damnation to himself. That is from Corinthians, in the biblical statement. St. Paul's letter to Corinthians. Now and again there is another verse here. 13th verse, yajna shishtasina santu muchindi sarvakil bishegi punjadeti dagam paba ye pachandi atmagaranath. Literal translation is those who cook for themselves and eat themselves, they are eating sin. Those who cook for themselves and also for others, they are enjoying life here and life hereafter. That's a literal, simple implication of this statement. So those who take from nature but giving back to nature. When we cut down trees, we can plant some seeds, new plants. This is one way of giving back to nature. When we block the flow of the river by creating dams into electricity or hydroelectric projects, we are disturbing the natural phenomenon. The mighty river flows to the sea. It's wonderful, it's okay to make use of the river, the water, for electricity, for irrigation. It's wonderful. That is wonderful. But we can keep the river, the water, the air pure without being disturbed, without bringing disharmony to its natural existence. Then we are practicing rhythm, we are practicing yajna, we are practicing what is the art of giving back to nature, a fraction of what we take from nature. So that is the real implication. So this verse tells us, those who are practicing yajna and they take everything from nature and give nothing back to nature, they are actually eating sins. That literal meaning, eating sins. That means the give and take policy, interdependence and interrelatedness. So we bringing this element of yajna or unselfishness by practicing detachment and selfishness. I already mentioned this earlier, and this helps us to work with great enthusiasm. It helps us to conserve our energy. If we live in perfect harmony with nature, with the perfect harmony, the cosmic rhythm, when we do not disturb this cosmic rhythm, we are conserving our energy, and we are living in this world, working in this world, and also enjoying life and work. And the moment we disturb it, it becomes something else. One of the reasons why great men and women the world is produced, you can count in your fingers or all the great spiritual leaders, but Christ or Buddha or Shankaracharya, Ramakrishna, Paramahamsa, all of these great men and great women, Saint Teresa of Avila, all these great men and women, if you read their life, something very interesting. They had tremendous energy. So where did they get this energy? Let us say, Christ for 30 years, Shankaracharya 32 years. And quite a good number of spiritual personalities. They lived for a short life. Some of them, of course, long life. Buddha lived for 80 years. How could they work so much and accomplish so much? And remember, the work they did should not be judged by the volume of physical work they did during their time. We should also judge their actions by the impact, by the continuing impact of their work over humanity during the succeeding centuries after their passing away. So that also should be counted. This Gita we would not have read today if a great saint in 8th century had not written a commentary on this book. The book is very ancient, goes back to 3rd millennium BC, but Shankaracharya, who lived in 8th century, wrote a commentary. That's why we are reading this book. And he lived for only 32 years. He is considered to be the greatest philosopher of India, who established monasteries, installed temples, established 10 monastic orders, wrote the most magnificent Sanskrit poetry and the philosophical theses. So Christ, for example, 30 years. So you find these great men, how could they work so much without being tired, fatigued? That's because they were practicing this yajna. I mean, in perfect harmony with the world, with the cosmic. And again, they are working for the good of others. We work for the harmony of the world only when we work without a selfish motive. When we work with a selfish motive, then we exploit nature. In fact, Lord Krishna is going to explain again, there is an inherent rhythm and harmony. Lord Krishna is going to say, he says, rains fall in the rivers, rivers are filled up, and rivers flow to the ocean, and again the sunlight turns them into clouds, and again it comes back as rains. This cosmic cycle continues, benefiting humanity. So you find a kind of interrelatedness. The moment we disturb, let's say I give the example, cutting down trees, polluting rivers, immediately we are violating this cosmic rhythm. And as a result, more hospitals, more diseases, more neurotic patients, more cases of anxiety and so on. So what happens? So it disturbs the inherent rhythm of the cosmic life and also our own individual life. That's because, so it is called we cook and we eat and we enjoy. This is one approach, and that disturbs the cosmic rhythm. The result is misery. On the other hand, when we cook for others, it's a symbolic language. Pachanti atma karanat. Those who cook for their own benefit, they are eating the poison of sin. Sin means evil deeds, the results of unworthy deeds. That's literal meaning here. But those who take things from nature while doing something to preserve the inherent harmony, beauty and the charm of nature, and preserving nature, its purity and its integrity, by giving back to nature a fraction of what we take from it, we are actually then practicing yajna or unselfishness. So Mahatma Gandhi, who wrote a commentary on the Gita, considered this as one of the greatest teachings of Gita. So we will have interaction for about 10 minutes. I will be happy to respond to questions on this subject or any related subjects.
So, can we interchange yoga and yajna? It sounded similar, like the terms.
Yoga here means karma yoga. Yeah. Karma yoga is one way of living in close integrity with this yajna concept. You practice yajna by practicing karma yoga with regard to your approach to action. Karma yoga means do everything with a sense of sanctity, without any selfish attachment to the results. Selfish attachment to the result. So a person who lives in close harmony with this yajna principle will naturally be unselfish in his actions. So look at Gandhi himself, who wrote a commentary on this, modern commentary. This is one of the latest commentaries emphasizing this yajna ideal, karma yoga ideal. When he was dying, he chanted the name of God 3 times. Now he and this man was practically giving headache to the British rulers all his lifetime. He was a politician. If you judge him by what he was doing, he was not sitting under a tree like Buddha meditating, no. He was all the way walking and organizing people, mobilizing agitations. But in every one of these activities, even while running an agitation against the government, he was practicing yajna. I think I am giving Gandhi's example because it is much more easy to practice these great ideas if you are sitting in a secluded place, if you are just an individual in your family setting. See? But somebody who was so active all his lifetime, and practically engage in activities which are outwardly not very spiritual, you know, organizing the masses and agitations. Not necessarily very spiritual. Though he was spiritual all his lifetime. And he was always in close harmony with this yajna ideal. So he had no complaint. He had absolutely no worry. And he was a highly educated barrister who had taken his degree from Inner Temple. He was a barrister, one of the most competent lawyers who practiced in South Africa, and then left that job, went back to India, took up the leadership of the political party, became its next leader. So I'm giving his example because most unlikely example for a spiritual context. So you find many such examples. In the American context, you can find many great men in this country, Lincoln, Martin Luther King. You find examples, great men, who have brought in some kind of higher idealism into their thinking and their actions. You find in different traditions and civilizations, you find this in different ways. Of course. Come.
Namaskar. So Swami, when you're, let's say Yvonne and I are building a farm.
Farm.
Yeah, we're farming and doing apples and we're, yeah, you know, and I'm doing all the work. I'm planting the seed, I'm watering the plant, and he's just, you know, not doing as much, doing a little watering and he's relaxing. So sometimes in life we get very competitive. You know, Yvonne isn't doing as much as I am doing, and I'm doing my yajna, and sometimes our mind gets caught up in this, you know, I'm doing more work than he is. Can you speak to that a little bit here?
Well, this is joint venture.
Joint venture, yeah.
Then it's, maybe he may be able to contribute in another area. He may be able to make greater contribution in another part of another area of the work. You may be doing the physical work right now. That's later on he may also do. You can't say that he is not practicing yajna. I don't say that. He may also, since you're jointly doing this, it shows this an integrity and in harmony between you. Otherwise, you won't start this project. So go ahead. Yeah, anything any activity that involves effort to make food grains or fruits, that's wonderful. That's it. But what I mean to say, this. The opposite of yajna is any kind of violence that agitates the inner harmony, purity, or the pristine nature of the world. That's you are preparing, building an apple farm is not something like that. Okay. Yeah, really, that's good. Yeah. It's an ancient work, so you can find the idea of mental serenity, contentment, physical health. Body also you find, if you eat bad food, drink bad water, the body agitates. It is the opposite of yajna. When you drink pure water, so similarly when we give something to others, let's say an unhealthy, undesirable action, some harm you do to another person. On the one hand, the other person is, he will suffer. Secondly, it produces another effect in your mental system that remains very strong, accumulated negativity in your mental system. And that will come up again and may agitate the mind later.
Swamiji, Swamiji, you mentioned riddham, yeah, and if you look at what's going on in the world these days, we're destroying the environment. And so I'm just wondering how to go from this, say, philosophical principle and how to put it into action, you know, in our lives, you know, with the destruction of the rainforest and climate change and all that sort of stuff. And also the idea of helping others, it's easier in principle, but dealing with people is very difficult. So I was wondering if you could talk about that too.
That's precisely why we need a higher ideal to support our good actions. You may be doing the best for others. You may be thinking, speaking, doing all good for others. But when you don't get a reciprocal response for another person, you can get an opposite response. It could agitate our mind. So such people sometimes take refuge in skepticism. They become totally disconnected, disappointed. That happens. So once you develop a higher ideal to support your good actions, then any kind of negative response will not bring in skepticism or cynicism or disappointment. That's what happened to great men and women who did great things. Unless they had a higher ideal at their own subjective level, apart from what they were doing for others, they wouldn't be able to sustain that activity, continue that activity. The slightest negative response could take you away from your ideal. But once you have a strong ideal in your mind, then this philanthropical activity, good actions, will become a natural habit. Then only becomes something sustaining and supporting, more lasting.
What about with the destruction of our environment? You know, what do you think about what should be done about that, or on a practical level? What, you know?
People are organizing, they're doing what they can, bringing more awareness of the problem of disturbing environment. A lot of that can be supported, but should be done in a very peaceful, non-violent manner. Because if we do, if we become too excited, that also, instead of doing any good, it can do the opposite. So that's the thing. There is a spiritual way of even agitating, as Gandhi showed, you know. There is a spiritual way of opposing somebody. A spiritual way of saying no to another person. So that's the idea behind.
Swami, maybe an extension of this gentleman's question about the environment and the destruction. If more people were to believe in reincarnation, especially what we call political leaders, wouldn't they have an existential position of "I'm coming back, so I better shape up and make it better for everybody"?
Yeah. Now, the fear of reincarnation, belief in reincarnation, can be a very constructive, creative, correcting mechanism. A fear of God, you know, sometimes fear of God becomes very limited when you feel, well, one day I can confess everything and I can start all over again, kind of license the navel. That's one problem, you know. So if one believes in reincarnation, then you may have to come back again and pay the price for it, that fear. That kind of,
I was thinking more of it in a positive sense.
It's, yeah.
Because some of the
political leaders are so myopic. Mm-hmm. It's this instant gratification, this very imperial, materialistic bank account. And the spirituality of our existence suffers from their ignorance, their cruelty, their destruction.
There have been great men everywhere, you find. If you look at American history, you find Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, great men who more than 150, 60 years back thought of all these great ideas. So think of, say, every nation has produced, maybe their voices may not be very well heard in every age. That happens, it goes on changing. A lot of changes happened between the last of the transcendentalists and our own time. The First World War, Second World War, and a lot of the emergence of the colonizing or military industrial complex. All this happened, but still there are great men and women who think of great ideas, you know. So that's true. That's true. Yeah. Every era produced great men and great women who thought differently, who felt differently, and who worked for the good of others, who in a way practiced this yajna ideal in different, in diverse ways, in different cultures, different traditions. This word is a Sanskrit word, but the ideal is not limited to one language or one culture. You find it in so many cultures, so many traditions, so many different ways. So thank you. I have a very important announcement, and that's very important. So there'll be no class for the next few weeks because I'm going abroad. So the next class in this old temple will be on January 24th. So we'll have no class for the next few weeks. And then, but during this time, we have a number of programs. I will be away only for less than 4 weeks, but we have a number of programs in the meantime. One is Thanksgiving, that is November 28th. We will have a program in Olima. Number of our devotees and friends gather and they discuss, they read some sacred books, Bible, they read something from the original books related to this Thanksgiving history of America. So, and then Christmas, we have an important celebration, the new temple, Value Street, Christmas, on 25th. So, and then you can see our website and get information. Then a very important program, that is on January 1st. That's one of our major programs. We will have Holy Mother's Puja. And January 1st, we will have puja, worship, discussions, reading, and a music program in the afternoon on January 1st. And then in January, we have a puja, a worship on 17th January. That is the actual birthday of Swamiji. And a public celebration of Swami Vivekananda's birthday on January 18th, 2020. And then a very important program, please remember, winter retreat. So we have winter retreat 2 days, that is January 4th and 5th. It will be held in the Vivekananda Hall, the new temple, 2323 Value Street. And the subject may be something very interesting to many of you. It is the spiritual psychology of mindfulness. So we may try to discuss Buddha's discourse, which originally in Pali language, Krishmadi Upatthana Sutta. With that, of course, the program will be in English. That is the spiritual psychology, maybe spiritual philosophy behind this mindfulness. That's called Winter Retreat on January 4th and 5th. So you can do RSVP. You can find more information in the website. Okay? So, thank you and wishing you happy Christmas. For you'll be meeting here, of course. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.